Welcome to part three of the Cyprus International podcast. We are continuing the conversation of what the Navy needs from industry to make unmanned systems more effectively support the warfighter in the distributed maritime operations environment.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We're back with the third part of our podcast trilogy on unmanned systems in the Navy. We'll be looking at where the Navy's going, what the future for unmanned systems holds, and what things the Navy needs help from, specifically from industry, to help them achieve their vision for the unmanned system future. So let me ask this question. If industry builds a network of autonomous systems that we discussed in the last podcast, has the department figured out how to modify existing command and control with a man in the loop? Jamie, you first, please.
Now, Jim, that's a million-dollar question. And so as we migrate towards unmanned and autonomous systems, with machines doing the lion's share of the work in the find, fix, and finish portions of the kill chain, I guess I'd have to ask the question, who is accountable? And where is the human decision maker in the loop? how do you modify rules of engagement, you know, to avoid a Vincennes-like mistake with the Iranian airliner or a Chancellorsville mistake, you know, whereby it was our own drone that hit that ship? And when does the commander have the confidence to switch to, you know, auto on or auto special, and not only ensure that incoming threats are neutralized, but that the machine will do so with due regard for collateral damage? And I'd love to hear Bob's thoughts on this.
Just initially, immediately, you know, get them out there. You know, them is the unmanned system. Start using them. Build familiarity. Demonstrate utility. Build trust. You know, I opened on the very first podcast when we first started talking about this, about the essential element of trust. You have to be used to these things. You have to be able to rely on them. And that doesn't happen overnight. So building familiarity through use, demonstrating utility, this is all what's required. It doesn't take a generation, but it also doesn't happen overnight.
Just back to you on this same area. How can industry help us with that? Do you think that the guidance from the departments coming down from, you know, the CNO office and so forth is sufficient to define the requirements, you know, the RFPs that industry needs to respond to the future autonomous fight?
You know, I do. To answer your question specifically, you know, I think, you know, the unmanned framework, I mean, the framework is there. Now it's a matter of executing it. You know, just to recap, you know, the why behind this unmanned campaign framework, you know, acting Secretary of the Navy, you know, Thomas Harker, you know, the bottom line was to build a more lethal and distributed naval force. That's the vision, you know, and he's focusing on tightly coupling the requirements, resources, acquisition policies to develop, build, integrate, and deploy an effective unmanned system faster. That's what he's focusing on. Those are his words of the why. You know, you go to the CNO. You know, the CNO is on record, and he says it in the beginning of the unmanned campaign framework. You know, the unmanned systems will continue to play a key part in future distributed maritime operations. You know, smaller platforms that operate in a more dispersed manner, you know, this is going to become an increasing focus. This is what CNO talks about. And then again, it's all about comprehensive strategy for realizing a future where unmanned systems serve as an integral part in Navy's warfighting team. So you add to those two voices the Commandant's voice as well, where the Marine Corps requires unmanned air, surface, and ground systems to fully exploit their, quote, inherent expeditionary nature and capabilities. And this is what the Commandant has said about the unmanned campaign framework and why it's so essential. Unmanned systems must and will take on a greater importance in our near future. So those are your senior leaders, obviously, in the Navy Department talking about this this unmanned campaign framework. But again, that's the vision. That's the commitment. Now we've got to go ahead and do it. And it's in partnership with industry. So then I guess to recap, it's pretty important here to talk a little bit about what's in the plan and how the approach is. You know, they talk about a commitment to a hybrid fleet up front. So number one, this is not about a replacement of the legacy force. It's a very logical and entirely, you know, predictable. It's an evolution. You know, a hybrid fleet up front, that's legacy plus unmanned systems, and a comprehensive approach in introducing those unmanned systems and this notion of human-machine teaming. And so if you look at the unmanned campaign framework, it has 8 functional pillar areas where the department's going to go after each of these areas with its own POAM. So you're talking about, you know, how you can really approach platforms and enablers, strategy, concepts, and analysis, fleet capability, RDT&E, people, education, talent, logistics, and infrastructure, even policy and ethics, and even communication and messaging. You know, those are all those 8 different pillar areas. And you take that and you kind of do a building block approach where the Navy then in the plan breaks down to, you know, key enablers and core technologies, and then unmanned platforms. You know, unmanned platforms are not the end all. You don't just get there and it becomes something that you force on the fleet and expect it to be used. It has to be mated to core technologies that evolve. But the key enablers are really the key piece, you know, and it's a move towards common standard interfaces, common data and autonomy libraries, integrated network, naval tactical grid, common control systems and interfaces. Consolidated staff efficiencies are realized if you have these things. Note the word about common and compatible. In the past, a lot of unmanned systems were kind of standalone. They had, you know, their own data standards, interfaces, their own, you know, autonomy libraries. They only worked in individual networks. The new approach is this commonality across all those core technologies, but also those key enablers. That's the difference that we're seeing today. Industry plays an integral role in that as they develop these common interfaces and common systems. So that's the key. It's a holistic approach. That's why it's called a campaign framework that talks about what it takes to get unmanned systems teamed together with the legacy force. You have to address all these eaches. Otherwise, it won't be accepted. They won't bring utility. It won't be easy to use.
Yeah, I can understand the Land of Misfit Toys kind of argument that goes with some of the early autonomous systems and understand how important it is to get to that utility. Admiral Fogo, do you have any thoughts on this? Over.
Yeah, Jim, I do. And I couldn't agree with Bob Moore on the fact that, you know, legacy and unmanned have to learn how to integrate with one another. Because, you know, like we said earlier, you know, 70% of the fleet is going to be around here in the next decade. And so we're going to have to maintain and modernize that fleet and work the fleet into the hybrid architecture that we're trying to develop. If you look at the vision statement in the unmanned campaign plan, and I'll read it briefly, it is to make unmanned systems a trusted and sustainable part of naval force structure, integrated at speed to provide lethal, survivable, and scalable effects in support of future maritime missions. How do you do that integration? How do you learn? How do you teach? How do you train the fleet to do it? I think that fleet battle experiments have come a long way. We were doing them on my watch over in Europe, and they have continued in conjunction with the live virtual concept of training. And what that allows you to do is to take outcomes and turn them around into changes in the way we fight faster than we've ever been able to do before. There's another piece in the campaign plan that says we've got to transition from reporting activities. So you do a war game, you write a report. You know, we would do these at Naval War College Global Games back when I was in 81. It would take a very long time to get that report out with conclusions. Nowadays, we don't have that time. You know, it's like McChrystal's book, Team of Teams. Got to have a quick turnaround same night. And you can do that with live virtual. So we want to drive action on high level outcomes that solve operational problems and increase capability immediately. It's got to be that way because of those razor thin margins we talked about in the past. The other thing about fleet battle experiments and live virtual is it's going global. And it's incorporating not just one COCOM, but many COCOMs, and should be all COCOMs and the building, the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. You know, as I read through the unmanned campaign plan, in my mind, I did a word map of common terms that were repeated over and over again. Bob and I and you, Jim, we've talked about that, and we'll talk about that again here in a couple minutes. But it reminded me of a simpler and more definitive approach that was used back in 1987 on the Defense Science Board for developing a report on the next generation submarine. So I was working at OSD Acquisition and Technology at the time, and I was a facilitator for a report, you know, which was a guy sat in a room, make sure everybody had what they needed, coffee and, you know, pens and paper. But I got to listen into all this. And this DSB report was led by a very well-known industrialist, the guy that had been out in cyber and space named John Stenbit. He's a great guy. He wanted to hear from warfighters. And so he asked for names of people that could come in and talk to us about, you know, how are we going to design? What are the recommendations we should put in a report to design this this next generation of submarines? Admiral Willie Hilarity, as everybody knows Willie, is a classmate of mine. He goes, hey, you should talk to my boss. He's the Army J3 on the Joint Staff, a Lieutenant General serving in the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he was a tall, lean, three-star Army officer. And Mr. Stenbit invited him over. And so he came to talk to the group. And I remember he took off his jacket, turned his chair around and sat down. And he was a Vietnam War veteran. And I recall that he said, hey, I don't know anything about submarines, but I know about the B-52. And, you know, it was assumed that the B-52 had saved his bacon a couple of times in his life in the Army. And he goes, so if I were you, I would write a report that recommends that in this new submarine design, you build a big truck and make it mutable. I never forgot that. And you know what? That was prophetic at the time, and it still is today. Now, about the same time, Admiral Skip Bowman took over as director of Naval Reactors. He was my boss when I became the senior member of the Horse Board, and later I became his executive assistant at Naval Reactors in the Navy Yard. Admiral Bowman was a Duke University grad, as well as an MIT combined master's degree program grad. And he was just brilliant. He had his own patent for some device in nuclear safety, as I recall. He was brilliant at the basics, but he was also a master communicator. And, you know, for future submarines, he came up with something he called Bowman's Four Gets. And they were simple requirements. And this was a message to those in the public-private partnership that were going to help us build this next submarine. He said, get connected, get modular, get payload, and get electric. And, you know, those four gets, as simple as they were, became bumper stickers for industry and how they spent their IRAD money in developing a winning platform in competition for those RFPs and contracts. And I remember one year, another favorite guy from Congressional Research Service, Ron O'Rourke, everybody knows Ron. He was asked to come over and address the Surface Navy Association at one of their dinners by Admiral Harry Ulrich. And I think Admiral Ulrich was one of the senior guys in town at the time. And Jim, you were there too. And Ron O'Rourke came over and he diplomatically offered some constructive criticism to the Surface Navy for not having anything pithy like Bowman's Four Gets to define their requirements on the Hill and in industry and to the American taxpayer. So Admiral Ulrich went to work and he came up with a list of his own gets for the Surface Navy. And Admiral Bowman was clearly flattered by that, by the praise, but moreover by the application of a strategic communication in another line of the Navy in order to work with industry to get what the Navy needed. So I would ask today, what are the gets for autonomous and unmanned systems? Have we clearly defined it in the unmanned campaign plan? I think there's a lot in there. Are these needs reflected in future RFPs? I don't know the answer to that. Has the service reached consensus on this? I assume so, because the unmanned campaign plan was signed out by the leadership of the United States Navy. And so I think in partnering with industry, we have to kind of take the word map from the unmanned campaign plan and come up with a few 21st century gets for the future of unmanned and autonomous systems. And I'll just give you my opinion. And then I'd like to ask Bob what he thinks. But, you know, is it get the man or woman out of the loop, get lethal, get autonomous, get networked, get agile, get mobile, get integrated, get interoperable, get prototypes, get commonality, interoperability with our allies, get simple, get C2, and get competitive. Well, that's certainly a longer list than the short and pithy list that Admiral Bowman had. So, you know, you got to pick your top four or your top five here. But I think, you know, those are the drivers which we need as the bumper stickers of the mantras to move forward in this public-private partnership to make us the best fighting force in the world. And let me turn over to my friend and colleague, Bob Greer, and ask Bob for his perspective on this as well.
Yeah, thanks, Jamie. And I think it's a really good exercise to go through, you know, what it takes to take a fairly sophisticated concept, you know, and market it, if you will, make it easily understandable, make it a sticky theme, if you will. That doesn't cheapen it. It doesn't diminish it, but it helps increase its understanding. That's why it's essential. So, fully, number one, I absolutely agree with the importance and the value of those gets. You know, I think I'm not too far different from my take from what you just presented on the various gets. And as you do a word map of this 40-plus page document, those truly are things that come out. I'd offer maybe just a little bit of a variation on, you know, I think the attributes that we should be using now are now more functional, vice physical. So attributes in the past sometimes were physical, describing what the platform or the thing might be. I think increasingly, because we talked about networks, we talked about the achievement of effects, about that's now really the focal point, that we're talking about functions. So, you know, I think that is also new. And so it's as much, you know, this campaign and this framework for unmanned is as much about how we fight, you know, DMO, EABO, LOCE, you know, both Navy and Marine Corps concepts, than the what of the unmanned. It's more about the how. So I think the logical extension of capability-centric, vice platform-centric, is maybe the following. I'd offer common, you know, and there's a hierarchy, by the way, in several of these attributes, and some characteristics are nested below others. So common, you know, that addresses command and control. It addresses simplicity. It addresses commonality. I'd offer connectable. That speaks to interoperability, integration, the importance of networks. I'd talk about composable. That addresses agility, lethality, meaning that a system can be repurposed to do many things. You know, distributed, I think, is another one I would use. That addresses the value of mobility and again, network as well. You know, you opened earlier, Jamie, I talked about mutable. You know, I love it. And that's absolutely, it's timeless. You know, the ability for something to easily change. You know, that's what I think of when I think of composable, the notion that you have many parts and pieces together. They form a network. They can be then composed for the task at hand, you know, that they serve to sense and they can be repurposed then to contribute to a network that creates effects along the entire continuum of non-lethal to lethal. These are all elements that are in the vision. So, again, I think common, get connectable, get composable, get distributed. That would be my short list. I think if we're seriously considering, you know, and we are a truly hybrid fleet that truly talks about legacy and unmanned systems partnering together forevermore, then shouldn't those same characteristics also apply to the legacy force as well, if you really think about it, or at least help us decide which legacy force elements we retain? You know, that's a very active discussion. We're talking all about unmanned here, but in the end, it's about teaming and about how we think about legacy force and, you know, and where the funds come from. Again, this is a department decision, clearly, but in the end, it's really all the same in terms of the characteristics that we're after, whether it's a manned system or an unmanned system. I think that's a pretty powerful concept to the idea, this unifying theme of about capability-centric vice platform-centric. And if you really understand that, it starts to kind of even the playing field between what heretofore has been our, you know, capital asset intensive fleet and the way we fight.
Bob, Jamie, I really appreciate the time you've taken to discuss unmanned with us. I think that this is certainly going to be insightful to many of our listeners, and I hope that they get as much out of it as I've gotten. And I really do want to thank both of you for the great discussion, the insights, the operational perspectives, the, you know, what is the Navy trying to get to? I think it's clear that industry needs to have an understanding of that. And I'm sure we could continue to discuss this for hours, but I think we probably need to wrap this up. What I'd like to do then is turn over to each of you to give us your concluding thoughts, and then we'll finish up this podcast. Admiral Fogo, would you go first, please?
Hey, thanks, Jim. This has been a great discussion. And, you know, we talked earlier about, you know, the statement that any commanding officer fighting a 21st century campaign with 20th century strategy and tactics, and I would include in that 20th century hardware and software, is going to lose. And that's a pretty tough thing to swallow. But how we value and measure power in the 21st century is markedly different than some of the examples we talked about in the 20th century in the first part of the podcast. I think we overvalue industrial age metrics and means at our own peril in the 21st century. We've got to get with it. And like I said, you know, we almost need a Manhattan Project to leap forward in autonomous and unmanned systems in a very hybrid way to assist the legacy forces that are out there now and to serve as force multipliers for those legacy forces. And so I mentioned the NSC AI study, and believe it or not, I've talked to some of those affiliated with the study. And, you know, getting autonomous is an uphill battle on Capitol Hill, despite the forensic evidence that rising powers are pulling ahead of us in digital and unmanned systems. Some of this is political. Unmanned has no natural constituency. And by that, I mean, you know, shipbuilding and aviation interests and those in industry who are located in one particular region of the country see capacity in their, you know, capacity building in their interests as they see the future coming. Some of this is being a little bit stuck on legacy. There's been a lot of discussion on that amongst the service chiefs in the open literature. Legacy systems or capital assets comprise the vast majority of the force, and they're going to be around for at least another decade or 15 years. The total life cycle costs of these systems from the industrial age squeeze out discretionary spending for the new and innovative systems. You've heard the expression, we've got to divest to invest. But, you know, at the same time, we've got to hold on to what we've got and maintain our national security. So this is a really tough problem. And the margins for creativity in light of some of these budget pressures and readiness and modernization are very slim. So some of this is culture. We think in terms of communities or domains, and we spend careers on a particular platform. I'm a submariner, you know, and you guys are surface warfare officers. Warfighting has evolved as a part of the art of the possible, and it's dictated now by technology and innovation and application of new tactics. I would ask the rhetorical question, you know, why do we still have a wire-guided torpedo? Is there an autonomous alternative? And I'm sure somebody's working on that out there. The future is all about capability, and it's agnostic of platforms. And it ultimately has to be cross-domain. Some of this is meeting some pretty high pressure from combatant commanders who have to fulfill their missions on a day-to-day basis to maintain the security of the United States of America and our allies. And interestingly enough, some of the COCOM capability gaps have provided a demand signal that's driven unmanned systems, often at odds with service chiefs who want to put their money into readiness or modernization. So we need that public-private partnership and industry's help in not just pushing the I believe button, but helping everybody get, and I've heard this expression used around town frequently in the last few months, we've got to get comfortable being uncomfortable with unmanned and autonomous systems. There are some gaps and seams out there, and we've got to take those into account too. Let me just remind you about a discussion that's ongoing concerning hypersonics. You know, we've had some success there. The adversaries are also putting resources into hypersonics. I think it's important to remind everyone that this is not just about outsticking the adversary with a weapon that can go faster or can go farther, because they will have them too. You've got to be able to defend against these hypersonic systems. So that leads to a whole nother aspect of 21st century warfare and drone defense. You know, one of the case studies that I think folks are looking at now was back in the fall, not highly publicized, a few articles in the newspaper about a place in the Caucasus called Nagorno-Karabakh. You know, I have trouble pronouncing and spelling that, Jim, but it was a proxy war between Azerbaijan and Armenia last fall. And the proxy war was helped by Turkey and its supply of unmanned and armed aerial systems to the Azerbaijanis, particularly the Turkish Bakhtiar UAV. And they tested it in combat. And it was really, really good. They used combat drones, the Azerbaijanis, against the Armenians, against heavy artillery, against tanks, and against people and vehicles, command and control. And the statistics were rather staggering. Publicly acknowledged, 100 tanks destroyed, 100 artillery pieces, 150 vehicles, 60 air defense systems, 11 command and control bunkers, 8 ammo depots, and 4,000 troops killed on the Armenian side before they sued for peace. And so we got to think about this from the standpoint of both offensive and defensive systems. Now, some will try to dismiss that and they'll go, well, you know, we have detection and intercept systems that would destroy drones overhead as well. I mean, look at, with our help, Israel built the Iron Dome system, and we're seeing that real time right now, working very effectively against inbound Palestinian rockets. Well, I got to tell you, it didn't work very well on Al-Assad Air Base with the Iranian strikes that took place after the assassination of General Soleimani in January of 2020. Now, those were, you know, ballistic missiles, but we don't have a lot of forward deployed air defense artillery at forward operating bases around the world. And, you know, if you apply this construct to some of the new technologies you want to put out there, like the light amphibious vehicle deploying forward that the Marine Corps would like, it causes me pause. And, you know, Bob and I have talked about this, and I know Bob has got some compelling information to share on the Saudi Aramco strike last year that, you know, frankly looked like it was planned at CENTCOM, but it was really planned in Tehran. So a potential follow-on from this discussion might be, okay, we need autonomous and unmanned systems that will be in a hybrid mix with legacy systems. But how do we defend against those systems that are coming from the other side? You know, is it Drake, which is electronic warfare, or as General Jim Mattis used to say, both as an active duty officer and as SecDef, it's time to get kinetic with these drones and shoot them down. That brings in a whole host of questions for the warfighter. You know, from the standpoint of collateral damage and ethics. And so we're going to have to address that. And, you know, one of the things that industry can do is to put some thought and some resources and IRED into this problem as well. But let me pitch the football over to Bob Greer and see what he has to say about that. Bob?
Thanks, Jamie. Again, wonderful summary, taking us right up to the moment, quite frankly, of events that surround us and the relevance of this entire discussion today with you and Jim. So, you know, my thoughts in conclusion, you know, let me just recap where we've been and I think maybe where we ended up today. So the why of the unmanned campaign framework, survival. You know, it's essential for our naval forces to, number one, survive, number two, then operate, and then ultimately prevail in a multi-domain contested environment. And I stress multi-domain because it's no longer, you no longer have the luxury of just taking care of one threat set. It's really an integrated threat set that traverses all the domains. That's the nature of a truly contested environment. And we shouldn't be surprised by that, by the way. It's something we've seen coming, and it's going to continue. The why of the UCF, the campaign framework, it answers a growing threat from high-end competitors that have significant and growing capacity and the means to continue this growth. But, you know, as soon as I say those words, you know, from high-end competitors, it also answers the need to not be surprised by the non-great powers, you know, to not be surprised by anyone who has access to this technology. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a couple of seconds. The how and the what of the unmanned campaign framework, you know, it leverages Department of the Navy's total force. You know, so what is that? That's the legacy, the unmanned existing fleet. You add to that the newest pieces, the unmanned together. That's the hybrid fleet. That's the new normal. That's CNO's vision. It also weds this hybrid fleet to the department's latest warfighting concepts, specifically, you know, distributed maritime operations, which is called out in this plan. So this is the first time really you're seeing a pursuit for acquisition, for development that gets right into it up front. It wires in, you know, requirements and acquisition approach, but also a warfighting, an operational concept. All those three are bundled together. That's what's new and different. And that's why I think that this is all about really getting towards success. You know, it factors in DMO along with the expeditionary, the Marine Corps concepts of a littoral ops in a contested environment, advanced expeditionary, advanced based operations. All three of those things working together. Unmanned represent nodes. Again, my term, but I think it's a way of normalizing, if you will, all the elements in this hybrid fleet, and are required to realize these new operational concepts. You know, on adapting to disruptive technologies, you know, middle powers, quite frankly, you know, Jamie just gave us a great example, you know, of a conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh that not a lot of folks heard about. The fact is, whether you hear about it or not, these systems are out there and they're being used, and they're pretty darn effective, especially if you're not prepared for them or looking for a challenge or a threat coming from this direction. So middle powers in many ways, are maybe, you know, even better suited than your great powers that are, you know, to rapidly take on these new technologies. And why do I say that? Because they have relatively fewer capital assets and are less heavily invested. They've got more margin to spend, so to speak, and they're not as deployed as routinely as others. That's not an indictment of how we're doing business right now. It's just a reflection of what is, and the fact that you need to not be surprised by these things. You know, as Jamie alluded to, the Saudi Aramco strike is really an eye opener. So this is less than 2 years ago, and you look at the readily available satellite imagery, you know, widely circulated on the internet. Oh, by the way, that's another new normal, right? Satellite imagery on the internet with pretty good accuracy. You know, this is the stuff you used to get briefed on, right? And very special, you know, exclusive, you know, classified meetings. It's now the domain of the commercial space, unclassified. So you see these pictures. You see this incredibly well-executed precision strike on a key infrastructure. And the question immediately comes to mind, my gosh, you know, who else can do this? But then the better question is really who can't, you know, and this is the wake up call. You know, the other non-major powers are already harnessing new and fast evolving technology. You know, so to over rely on technologies, metrics, methods of the last century, Jamie mentioned this in his wrap up comments. Those are the metrics of the industrial era. Good work, impressive, long track record. But we shouldn't cling to them exclusively. We do that, you know, at our own peril. You know, let me add to that, you know, another anecdote. You know, just a little more than 2 years ago, you know, at the this is in 2019 at the International Defense Exhibition IDEX in Abu Dhabi. You know, there was a company you may have heard of that unveiled a new system for sale. It's 4 feet wide, 30 minute endurance, 80 miles per hour, 40 mile range, 6 pound explosive, low cost, efficient, easy to employ. It was the Kalashnikov exploding drone. No joke. And again, you can Google this as well. It was marketed as the, quote, new AK-47. No kidding. So, you know, this stuff's out there. That's over 2 years ago, and it's proliferating, you know, all around us. So why DMO? Why distributed maritime operations? You know, the part and parcel of this unmanned framework and campaign plan. You know, we need to build a force, you know, a joint force, by the way, wherever able, but also combined force that brings in allies and partners that sees farther, understands faster, reaches longer. You know, that's the goal. Decision superiority and the means to drive effects that shape the battle space based on a superior knowledge cycle. You know, in the end, if you understand the battle space and better, you can accurately forecast where it's going. Then you're in the position to shape versus react. And this makes all the difference in deterring and, when necessary, winning the high end or, for that matter, any fight. So what does the future look like, in my humble opinion, and what I think the unmanned campaign frameworks really seeks to address? I think, you know, all domain contested fighting is here to stay. This is the new normal. And in many ways, it's an unending fight. It's an environment characterized by continuous friction and the need to sustain persistent and perpetual deterrence. And in order to do that, you look at getting all the kit you got available, the legacy force that's manned. You made it together with the new, the unmanned. This is the hybrid fleet that CNO talks about. Thanks again for taking the opportunity, at least giving me the opportunity to share these insights or thoughts with you, Jim. Jamie, is always a pleasure working with you, my friend, and looking forward to having this discussion continue later.
To our listeners, we will have another podcast on artificial intelligence featuring the Honorable Katrina McFarland, former Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition. We will be following that up with a podcast covering the future of naval aviation, and in particular, the composition of the future naval air wing. We look forward to providing you with the same level of analysis and insights that we've provided on unmanned systems here today. Thank you very much.
This podcast was made possible by Cypress International. Please visit us online at www.cypressintl.com.